27.
Right. The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3497. Day, do you want to give us the particulars on this one, and then we'll hear from our panel.
Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, this House Bill 3497 comes to us from Education Committee with unanimous vote recommendation. It increases the minimum ESD grant to, with the Ashto Amendment, to $1.165 million per year, and there is an escalating clause. That's a brief summary of it.
Let's hope it's an escalating clause.
Okay. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Huffman, representative for House District 59. Day mentioned an escalating clause, and I think we'll have to address that because I don't. Did the amendment do that, Day?
It's in the original, actually, yes.
Fluctuates.
It goes up. It does fluctuate.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry.
Escalating.
You scared me there, and I just wanted to get that.
It's a minus escalation and a plus escalation clause.
So, House Bill 3497 is a product of a work group of all stakeholders. And so I'm going to start at the beginning. The state school fund, the first 4.5%, or K-12 might say the last 4.5%, but anyway, 4.5% of the state school fund is dedicated to ESDs. And for the last 12-ish years, something like that, the Frontier ESDs, as I call them, there are five of them, have had a $1 million floor. Over the years, many years, that ended up being more of a ceiling than a floor. Mm-hmm. And so all ESDs got together, including the 16 members of the Oregon Association of ESDs.
14
members. And then the five floors, so all 19 ESDs got together, and as of about 10:30 yesterday morning, we all agreed on the adding $165,000 to that $1 million floor ceiling, and we came up with the 1.165. So we are locked in arms singing Kumbaya before you today.
Very good. I assume the others. Oh, yes.
And
please,
Mr. Chair,
please go ahead.
The room next door is calling me, so I'm going to excuse myself, but thank you very much.
And we assume that Ozzy has your proxy.
He does.
All right.
And maybe even Rob.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Excuse me. For the record, I'm Ozzy Rose. I represent the Oregon Association of ESDs. And the only thing I'd add to that is the $1 million floor was put in. We called it a floor, and it turned into a ceiling. And the proposal ups the floor and creates a floor or ceiling, depending on how the legislature does it, funding education overall. And I think it's fair, and should have done it sooner.
All right. Yes, sir.
My name is Rob Myers. I represent North Central Grant and Wallowa ESDs, and I live in Condon. Just to echo what Representative Huffman and Ozzy said, this has been a process that's resulted in what we consider to be an equitable outcome, and we certainly would encourage the committee to go ahead and move it through. Thank you.
Thank you. How many ESDs would this affect positively? I assume it affects the others negatively. Five.
Yes.
So if I can do my arithmetic, and I probably can't, it's less than $1 million altogether.
Mr. Chair, it's $825,000.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's...
How did you get... And this may be asking too much, but if you can tell us, how did you get the others to agree to take that kind of a cut?
That, Mr. Chair, Ozzy Rose, that was my responsibility, and it was hard.
Well, Mr. Chair, Rob Myers, the $825,000, which is the $165,000 cumulatively from the five, represents 35 hundredths of 1% of the application. So it's not a giant.
Not a big amount.
No, it's really not.
Only thing I'd add to that, ever since we've had this kind of a formula, anything you take from me is a big amount. That's the trouble we had with some of those folks.
course, that doesn't alter the fact, Mr. Chair, that it's 3,500 or 1%.
$1.20 per ADMW, is that?
Yes.
That's what Day is telling me. How many of these are in representative, how many of these ESDs are in Representative Bence's district?
Two, I believe. Isn't it Harney and Lake?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lake, yeah.
Okay. That's my district.
Yes, Representative Bence. I thought I was going to see if I could get you to ask your question.
Yeah, I've just had a couple. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you guys for all your work on this. It's a great big deal to folks out of my area, to say the least. And the third bullet point on the staff measure summary says that ESD inability to provide required services has having led to increased costs to school districts. Where have you fallen short mostly? I think I know the answer, but tell us.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Ozzie Rose again. That particular issue is as districts have lost revenues, they're depending on, they're getting service from ESD. The ESD loses revenues, they lose services. By and large, those services were special ed assistance, professional growth, I think, are the two biggest ones. You'd have to go to look at each ESD to find out what they were, and I do not have that information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, Rob Myers again. For instance, Representative, the Grant ESD has incurred a 40% reduction in staff over the same period of time. And so what happens then is that the ESDs aren't able to provide the services to the school districts that they could previously free of charge. So the school districts, in order to be able to provide those mandated services, have had to dip into general fund monies to provide those services themselves. So there is a ripple effect with respect to lack of funding at the ESD level.
Mr. Chair, it had been my understanding in conversations with Burns in Harney County and others that the special ed piece was overwhelming them, and this was hugely important for that purpose. And so is that consistent with your understanding of one of the, I'm guessing that was one of the reasons you were successful in your wrestling some of this money away from
you. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Grants, that's correct, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. For 15 months, I represented House District 55 after the redistricting in 2001. And I got to Paisley for a visit with the school district there and met with the then superintendent, I believe his name was Hall, of the Lake County ESD. And what I learned, and I don't know if this is still true, was that the ESDs in these very small, very large geographic areas, very small student areas, provide a lot of services that in places like Lane County are done by the local school districts, simply because the ability to accumulate enough students to do something is much more difficult in these smaller places. And I'm assuming that's a big chunk of why this is an issue for those small ESDs.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's correct. You can't create economies of scale where there is no scale. And so what the Frontier Rural ESDs do is utilize an aggregated resource model. So they share resources based on the fact that that's the only other way they can provide the services.
Great, thank you. Colleagues, we're discussing what's the name of the bill? House Bill
3497,
in which the ESDs have apparently agreed that it's okay to raise the minimum, which is Mr. Rose has told us is the maximum, from $1 million to $1.165 million. So that's what the discussion is. This is the only panel after Representative Huffman. So if you have any questions, now's your chance. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do notice the amendments here. Are those in the dash two amendments? Are these already incorporated in the bill? That change that threshold or that amount from 1.36 million, so to speak, down to 1.165?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, yes, dash A2 lowers this minimum grant
Well, the question was it already in the bill? And the answer, I think, is it is not in the A engrossed.
Not in A version, but dash A too, yes.
So that would be up to us.
Yes, my question would be why.
But this represents the agreement made by the ESDs among themselves.
Okay.
Have I got that right, Mr.
Yes,
Rose?
Sir.
Yeah. Yeah, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you go back again and say the percentage? Was it 3,500ths of 1%? Is that what you said this amounted to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, yes, that's correct. $165,000 is 0.07 of 1%, and the 825 is 3,500ths of 1% of the ESD allocation out of the state school fund.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else for this panel? This is all we have on this bill. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3497 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2968. That's also yours?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2968 also comes from House Education Committee with no opposition. It directs a school district to prepare and file an annual report The bill directs a school district to prepare and file an annual report related to the amount allocated for students in poverty families. It details the contents of the required report, and it directs the ODE to report to the legislature in even-numbered years. On the data collected. And with the dash A2 actually changes the due date from September 1 to November 1 of even numbered years.
Representative, looks like you're on deck.
Thank you, yes. Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, and Vice Chair Vega Peterson, how are you? Thank you for having me. Joe Gallegos, State Representative, House District 30. Oh, I already said hello. Thank you for having me. Seriously, here he is, my partner in crime here. I'm really here just to demonstrate the bipartisan support for this bill. And the bill will allow state to gather data on each school district on the outcomes of funding for low-income / poverty children in schools statewide. The data will outline the dollar amount allocated to each school district from the state school fund and how those funds were spent to support children from poverty families. Department of Education will report to the legislature to determine the outcomes from funds allocated to the school districts who supported students from poverty families. And, you know, basically, I'm not ever in favor of collecting data just to collect data, but I think this bill aims at the meat of the problem that we all want to solve. The bill will provide transparency, accountability of funds allocated to students in poverty, and give the state an opportunity to track outcomes and progress. Again, my purpose in being here right now is really to demonstrate the solidarity in which we're approaching this. I think also just to draw attention to the fact that this is really sort of one bill in a number of bills that we're putting together to really address some of the issues with regard to K-12.
Yep. Great job. I don't need to say anything.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Honorable committee members, for the record, I'm Gene Wisden, House District 53, and I really appreciate my colleague speaking out in support of this bill. The representative and I have worked together this whole session on trying to look at ELL and also poverty. There is a dash two that you have, I think, in OLIS, and all that did is that came from ODE because our bill said the school districts were going to report September the 1st to ODE, and we're immediately going to report to us. And this gives ODE time to analyze that report and to report back to the legislature in November. So that's the dash two. I support that, and it's just that one word change. I have a little PowerPoint. It's going to get a little confusing, but I think it's revenue. You need to look at some numbers of how important this is that my colleague has talked about. And what I did, what you're going to see here is I reference a 2967 sometimes is about ELL. And what we did is that bill was included in the Good Representatives Bill 3499. So 3499 now addresses a report on ELL spending, and also the Good Representative included another good part about that as far as the limitations on how long school districts is that could receive ELL. So let me see.
Can I interrupt for just one second? I actually have another appointment up in my office, so I'm going to excuse myself. But if you have any hard questions, everybody will be right here.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you.
Thank you
for your support. So as the slide shows that originally I had two bills. One asked for a report on how the ELL money is being spent, and a second report separate, which we are addressing today. That's the bill you're voting on today, is 2968, as amended now to be amended with a dash two. And that talks about a report on the money that's spent for poverty out of the state school fund. As the good representative said, I had bipartisan support of both of these bills. And there's definitely a need for this money, but there's also a definite need to report it and see how we're spending it. As I hope you all know, basically from the state school fund, each student gets $6,000 per school year. Each ELL student gets an additional $3,000. And if a student comes from a family in poverty, they get another $1,500. Okay, if you look at that, it's a lot of money. This slide here shows you, again, I've got the both combination of ELL and poverty. And for your information, ODE did confirm these numbers today. I had a mistake. Is that the old? That's the old one. That's the old one. Yeah. There's another PowerPoint. Can we change it? The most recent one. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I had 57, and I think they're going to give us 40-something thousand. I forgot what date it is.
It's about 47,000.
I should have checked.
Oh.
But you can see we're going to change the numbers for you, but I think it comes down to $523 million combined for ELL and poverty. It's a lot of money. It's okay. I'll go on the numbers. We can come back. The poverty is correct. The numbers in poverty, the ELL numbers are wrong. I think it's supposed to be 47,000 or 42,000.
Oh, the corrected one
right
is
here. Yes, 47,122.
And colleagues, the corrected one is now up on OLIS.
Yes, sir, it is.
Under the materials section.
Yeah, I have two in there because. You picked up the other one, and I corrected it and sent it in when we got the changes. So I think we're okay to go ahead.
Yes, please.
Because the other stuff, I think there were some changes were made a little bit, but nothing significant. So ODE requires school districts on the ELL to submit a report on how much is received and how much is spent. But down to the bottom, which is our bill we're addressing today, there's no reporting requirement for how much is allocated or how it's spent for the poverty money. And that's what we're trying to address here. There was a task force during the interim that looked at the school funding formula, and nothing really action except the good representative, Senator Devlin. And I've worked with him on these bills, so he knows I'm not going behind his back or anything on the bills. But they did acknowledge that there need to be more accountability and transparency of that money. So these two bills just seek transparency and accountability of over $520 million of allocation for ELL students and students in families of poverty. The bill's simple. It says ODE is going to work with the school districts to come up with how to report it. We're going the wrong way, excuse me. This is just for your information on ELL. You'll get that. You may get that or you may not. It's interesting that Washington State only gives $930 per student for ELL. And also, so you know, in addition to the money that's coming out of the state school fund, the schools also receive Title I and Title III funding. Mm-hmm. And that's separate. And in OLS, you also, I gave you a complete copy of the Ben Lapine report to the federal government on the $160. And I think our report's going to be more simple than that. But if you look at the pages 8 through 12 on there at your leisure, it lists codes and how much, how they report what they've done, teachers, parent training, or things like that. So, so again, look at the bottom. I talked to the school nurses, and this is just thinking outside the boxes. With $250 million, if we spent $50 million of that money, we could put a school nurse in ever elementary school in Oregon. I have that from the Nurses Association that they could do that. Some schools have a school nurse, but if you families with children, families in poverty with children in school, health care is important to them. And to have a school nurse would be very important to how to use that money. And I've confirmed with ODE that they could use, you know, the school district wanted to use whatever money they're getting to hire a school nurse, that would be acceptable under the legislation we're proposing. So quick, apologize for the incorrect on the ELL, but the one we're looking at again, Mr. Chair and committee members, is the poverty. Simple bill, simple report. We hope that maybe as we get into it, we may want to make the report more detailed, but at least we can account for what schools are doing with it and if they are spending it for this purpose. I'd be happy to accept questions. I think you're also, I don't know if Stand for Children is going to testify. You do have a letter of support from Stand for Children, mm-hmm. that I appreciate their support of this.
They haven't signed up to testify. Okay. But
there's a letter in NOLIS.
There's a letter that yes. will count as their testimony. Questions for the good representative? Yes, Representative Lyons.
Thank you. It's not a question. It's a comment. And I want to thank you for bringing this legislation together with Representative Gallegos. It's a strong team. And I also think that as we try to be more effective in how we use funds and transparent in the outcomes that we generate, It's important across all domains to be getting outcome data and making sure that we're using money in an efficient way. So thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for the comments. It really is. That's one of my priorities since I've been here. And also, it's really important to parents of children that from poverty and that don't speak, that are English as a second language. And it's also important for children, from parents of children that do speak English is their first language. So we, you know, I think if we look at this and try to find ways to be sure we're spending it right, it could benefit all our children and hopefully smaller classes and more teachers.
Thank you. Other questions? I have Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You said no questions.
Good representative. Appreciate you being here. So just for clarification now, you've been interchanging two different bills. There's 3499, which is a separate bill, correct?
Yes, sir.
And that deals with strictly English language learners, right?
Yes.
And this bill, 2968, is specifically directed at poverty, correct? Poverty funding and or spending. Okay. My question, one of my questions would be, what's the definition of poverty? Is there a commonly held understanding for income levels? Is it just free and reduced lunch? What's the...
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think, Representative, they're using the federal definition.
Maybe
but
ODE
there's someone from
that.
They do know the answer.
They can answer that.
Bring in Michael. He knows the definition.
Okay. Is he here?
Yes.
Michael. Sorry?
Michael Elliott.
Michael Elliott, do you want to answer that question for us? When you ask a representative an expert question, it's always wise to get the expert.
That's a good question. I should have had that one. Michael will have the answer.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, for the record, Michael Elliott, Oregon State School Fund Coordinator, Department of Education. There are two definitions of poverty commonly used. One that a lot of the school districts use to distribute funding within the school district is the free and reduced lunch count. That count goes up to about 185% of the poverty level at the federal government. Mm-hmm. The funding definition that's actually deriving the weights in the system is based on U.S. Census data. That's the small area income poverty estimate, and that is a district-by-district yearly estimate of poverty based on several different data sources from the federal government.
And that is the formula that we just changed recently, right? ODE came up with a different metric based on census data from 2010, I believe, right?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, correct. Before we switched over to this new federal, the census data, we were using year 2000 census data because the decennial census stopped counting poverty as part of the decennial census. They moved away from the long form, if you remember. So that's what we were using, and then in 2010, they no longer had that data source. They had moved to this yearly changing small area income poverty estimate.
Okay. Well, yes, please. Uh-huh.
And then, Representative, in addition to trying to determine how the poverty funding formula is allocated or used, you're also looking for some data on outcomes. Would these be academic outcomes for those students, or what do you have in mind there?
We're going to leave that to the school districts and ODE to work it out. As I said, excuse me, Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, we'll see where it goes. We may not, the first time around, I may not be satisfied. ODE may not be satisfied, but we are looking for outcomes and that you're using the money to produce outcomes. And poverty, it's going to, I think the outcomes are going to be longer term. You know, graduation, which we're already collecting some graduation rates, but school districts may come into that or they're advancing reading level, whatever, but I didn't want to make the bill too specific in saying what they have to report, and that's why I think I have good support from ODE, and I hope they're not going to have OSBA complain about it. But
I don't see them in the room. Well, yes, I do. One follow-up.
Yes, please. Uh-huh.
I guess my other question would just be, why the referral of revenue? Because I don't see, this could have been strictly a policy bill, could it not?
Anybody? That's a very good question. Contrary to popular belief, I only suggest, I don't actually control that, so I'm in the speaker's office.
Okay.
But I think it is a reasonable question. On the other hand, the information that comes from a report like this might very well affect our work on the funding formula.
Mr. Chair, I agree with your comments, but I think the speaker in the speaker's office may have thought because it was state school fund, just like you looked at ESD, I think that's
right.
That's why how they're spending.
Well, the ESD money. One is definitely an issue having to do with the formula.
Yeah.
This one, of course, is a study and doesn't directly affect formulas. Yes. Did you have other questions, Representative? I have one essentially, and I'm going to preface it by saying, when I meet with my superintendents in Lane County and even in the ones in Linn County, the first comment they make after they complain about not having enough money to hire teachers is, and you know what it is, that they have to fail out too many reports. Mm-hmm. And that some of them have even suggested that we ought to pass a bill that says if the department wants a report, they get to pay for it, even if it's ordered by the legislature. I told them that bill was not likely to move this session, but I understood the point. Is the department working on ways to either combine reports, simplify reports, figure out data streams so that information can be extracted, other than having the superintendents in these very small districts do it themselves? That applies to this bill, but also to a whole lot of other things. Mm-hmm. What's going on in that area to make life a little easier for my small district superintendents and then collaterally for me?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, they don't even give us the first comment, we don't have enough money. They start with too many reports. So we definitely hear that message as well. And I know the department has been working with districts to try to streamline, and we're very aware of adding what we call a new collection, a new data report, where it's all online, but still somebody's gathering that data, calling up their teacher, saying, hey, how much do you got here? What are you doing? That sort of thing. So we're very aware of that. So we would work with, especially in this particular bill, work with the school district to say, what current data do we collect? How can we use that to, get some reasonable answers at district levels that would, give the legislature some information that you can then use to make decisions as well, but also minimize the burden on districts moving forward, as so it's not just, here's another report you have to fill out. So we really would work with the districts to try and determine the happy medium between getting additional information, using the information we have, and then moving forward. I think for this one in particular, there is a little concern because poverty is a little harder to identify than, you know, an English language learner or a federally funded program, because those have different strings and different identifiers attached.
Okay, does the bill give you the authority to help outline what information you want so that the superintendent doesn't have to sit there and say, what do you mean by this?
Chair Barnhart, I believe, yes, that Representative Wisnett wrote the bill such that the Department of Education can determine the form and content of the report, so we would be able to work with the school districts to determine that.
Part of my vision about all this, I'm also on the Portals Commission, run by DAS, that is supposed to be setting up the state websites, including yours. Mm-hmm. One of the things that one of my fantasies, and it probably is only a fantasy, is that you'll collect all this data only once, and when somebody asks for a report, you'll extract the information from the pile of data you already have on a district, because it's all carefully built into a database, and you'll simply extract the data that's needed for that report so that the superintendent doesn't have to do it. How close are you to that kind of thing?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I don't know that I'm qualified to talk about the IT requirements for that report. I will go back and talk to our IT people and get you that information, because I do know they are also looking at, because it's a lot of work for ODE staff as well. So we are looking at how can we, you know, minimize the reports and make sure that the data is still good, because the concern with one report at one time is that data has to be perfect. And if districts aren't providing perfect data, then that data set becomes problematic in terms of making decisions and basing policy on it. But I will go back and talk with our information technology individuals to see what we're doing for that.
Okay. And I agree with Representative Wisnett that having this information would be very, very helpful. I don't want to go back to talk to my superintendents and say, gee, what did you do during the session? Well, we added three more reports for you to fill out.
Mr. Chair, but it is a lot of money.
Definitely.
And also, I didn't point out that in a lot of situations, and I don't know that OD can tell you exactly, but a lot of the people that are ELL are also getting both of those additional fundings. If you have time to look real briefly at some of the things in the Title III report from Ben Lapine, and that's one of the things where I talked to OD, and they've been very helpful in working with me on these two bills that are now in Representative Gagas's bill, the ELL. But the codes will not work the federal. It'd be nice if we'd use the same codes from the federal requirement, but that doesn't work. And again, this is a first attempt. I think we tried to make it simple. I didn't say, you know, we wanted to have down to the detail of each penny and dime, but let's find out what programs we are using that money to fund, and what is it helping these children succeed in school.
Yeah, and of course, to some extent, you have to get details in order to do that. I appreciate the need for this kind of report. I also am well aware that all of my superintendents, and I suspect in other districts too, feel completely overwhelmed by the requirements. I think probably most of them are federal rather than state, but they don't differentiate between what we order and what the feds order.
Mr. Chair, and Michael can maybe confirm this, but the manual to fill out the Title III is a significant number of pages to go through to get the No Child, actually came from the No Child Left Behind is where that money came from.
Okay. Does that generate any other questions from anyone? Thank you. And thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just to follow up, Ramin, or to add to the discussion regarding ELL is that, you know, for some of us in our districts, the ELL is virtually exclusively focused on Hispanic students and so forth, Spanish speakers. But there's a growing population of English language learners in some of our other metro area that are from various different language groups. But they're not always necessarily associated with the poverty. So there's not isn't necessarily that linkage here as we talk about other populations that are immigrating to our urban areas and stuff. So it gets to be a bit of a complicated dynamic in trying to delineate exactly where those resources go and how they're applied. So I do feel some empathy for the districts as we ask for some of these reporting criteria in some of these areas. But I'm sure you've had those discussions already, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. Working with the ELL for the last year and then working with Representative Gygas the last few months, I'm the representative on the Asian Pacific Island Advocacy Commission, and they've been very supportive of this too. The large Vietnamese population and some of the smaller islands too is a lot of immigrants that their children do not speak English. So it's not just that, and of course we have the big Russian speaking population in parts of our state too. One of the things I'm trying to think outside the box about, seeing if I could use some of that ELL money for Head Start and maybe some of the daycare centers. There's actually a daycare in my district that's trying to get qualified for Head Start, and they have a Japanese primary language speaker, and they've hired a Japanese person to come in the daycare to help that student learn English. I've been to some seminars where children start learning a foreign language at 3 years old, so I think the Head Start program would really get these children prepared to come into kindergarten and to the regular school system. So that's a discussion I'll have with outside the with other educators to see if we could look at trying some things like that to put some money there to start these children.
And of course, children start learning their first language at birth, so age three is getting a little late.
I think some of my colleagues, legislators, they say they can learn before birth, start here to doing the tapes and things. I've heard.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate the bill and the testimony, and let's see if we can wrap this one up. Good. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You.
Thank you,
with
Mr.
That,
Chair.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2968 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2130. Kyle.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2130, it would allow governing bodies to establish reasonable maximum holding times for land designated for low-income housing development, and it also allows governing bodies to elect additional qualifying criteria for the exemption. It would require additional criteria to not conflict with existing law that's in statute. The changes only apply to applications for exemption received on or after the effective date of the measure and the date on which the governing body adopts the either the reasonable maximum holding times or the additional criteria. It would take effect on the 91st day following adjournment signed you die. And the governing body in this case would be counties or cities. And just as a frame of reference, the changes in 2130 apply to existing partial property tax exemptions. They're listed in the tax expenditure report. Number 2105, new housing for low-income rental, and then 2106, nonprofit low-income rental housing.
Thank you. I have a panel, John Van Landing, Mark
Sansusi.
Sansusi? Mark Sansusi, thank you, and Dorinda Schubert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer with Lane County Legal Aid in Eugene. I am speaking in favor of 2130A. The bill comes from Beaverton, and I'm tagging along, but I support it. As you know better than most, property taxes in Oregon are a function of state law, but they support local government. This bill is about two existing property tax exemption programs that allow, not require, local governments to grant property tax exemptions to affordable housing developments in their communities. So, existing exemption programs, not new, and allow local governments to do this, not require them to do it. The bill allows those local governments, what it does with these amendments is to allow local governments to add on additional criteria if they adopt one of these programs. And that's why I support it. As an affordable housing advocate, I'm hopeful that it will encourage more local governments to use this tool. Right now, there is no one that tracks who's got these tools. DOR does not. I try to. It's anecdotal. My guess is that five local governments currently use one of these two. Over the last 30 years, I think up to almost 20 local governments have at one time or another used them. And Beaverton is one of those five. I'm going to describe how the two exemption programs work, although you may know more than I do. The chair is shaking his head. And then I'll explain why I think the bill is needed, and then I'll give some examples of additional criteria that a local government could adopt or add on. My written testimony is on OLIS. So, again, we're amending, this bill is amending two existing property tax programs. The initial statute in the each of the two is 307.517 and 307.540. Why are there two? There are some differences, not significant. The 307.517 can be used by a nonprofit corporation as defined by Oregon law, or by a for-profit corporation if the for-profit corporation can demonstrate to the local government that it is passing through the property tax savings in reduced rent. Okay? It's a tool that's used by some developers of affordable housing. And 517 also is available only for new construction, housing that's built after the local government adopts the ordinance. 540 can be used with acquisition, so housing that might have been built some time ago, so in older communities such as Portland, 540 is a tool that Portland uses. I guess I should have identified the five local governments that do this. Portland does it. Eugene does it. I know those two for sure. I believe that Tiger and Wilsonville do it, and Beaverton. So 540 can be used for acquisitions. It is limited to 501c3s, so charities. So that's a higher standard to meet than just simply being a nonprofit. The way it works is this. A local government wants to assist with affordable housing development. It chooses to adopt one of these two programs. It adopts an ordinance. If it can get 51% of the tax base, districts representing 51% of the tax base, it applies to all the taxing districts in that community where the property is located. Typically, that means the city and the school district. Eugene School District 4J, of which Chair Barnhart was a longtime member, has for a long time supported this program. Why do school districts support it? Sometimes because they support addressing the problem of affordable housing. But there's also an educational benefit to it. Students that are housed are more likely to be successful students. In addition, in gentrifying or aging communities, which I think Eugene qualifies as, it's a way to get families with children into your district instead of having those families live in Bethel or Bonita or in different school districts. So it's a way to increase the number of kids in your district. If you can't get to 51%, the exemption only applies to those taxing districts that adopt the ordinance. Okay. The governing body that adopts the ordinance monitors compliance, has an application process. If a property is out of compliance, the local government, the governing body, is required to withdraw the exemption. There's a clawback provision that can go up to 10 years to recapture the property taxes that were not in compliance. Both of these exemptions have been around for a long time. 317 was adopted in 1989. 317-540 was adopted in 1985. You have reviewed both of them in the last several years. You reviewed 307.517 in 2010. 307.540 you reviewed in 2011. They both have sunset dates that are out in the future, 2020 and 2027. So why do this bill? In my experience, there are a lot of local governments that would like to help with affordable housing. They often feel like they don't have many tools that they can use. This is one of those tools. But they're anxious about losing property tax revenue. School districts, too. So I have encouraged them in the past, and one specific example was with St. Vincent de Paul, a nonprofit in my community that does affordable housing development, wanted to do a project in Staten. Staten said, we're worried about how much money we might lose. Could we cap the amount of money, tax revenue, that we might forego with this? I was trying to help St. Vincent de Paul. My answer was yes. Staten's lawyer said, gosh, the statute doesn't say that you can do that. I don't think you can. My answer was, well, it doesn't say you can't do that. So we had two lawyers taking the opposite sides of the school district, and Satan chose not to do it because it wasn't clear that it could do that. This bill
will make it clear that local governments can adopt criteria like that. Some examples I've listed a bunch of them in my written testimony. The criteria that the local government could add would be things like that are consistent with their HUD consolidated plan requirements, being close to social services or transportation, that the applicant not be debarred by the federal government for fraudulent felony conduct or be a bad actor, that the applicant also be sincerely or show that he or she is sincerely interested in affordable housing. I think that's a particular interest in Beaverton, that there be a cap on the amount of revenue lost, that there be a cap on the number of projects approved, that vacant land can only be held for a certain amount of time before the development occurs. The last thing I'd note is that the bill comes to you from House Human Services and Housing, where it passed with one no vote from Representative Hayden. And I'd be glad to take questions if you have any.
Great. Let's do the others, and then we'll ask questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Mark Sanssouci. I'm honored to serve the city of Beaverton as a city councilor, and I have done so since November of 2008. I'm here today to speak in support of more affordable housing in Beaverton and in the state of Oregon, and to allow us to have some additional control over the way that the property tax abatements associated with these programs are administered and regulated. Beaverton understands that having housing at all income levels is critical for the well-being of our city, and these state-enabled nonprofit affordable housing development programs give us important tools to help make affordable projects pencil out by foregoing this local property tax revenue in exchange for the development of the affordable housing. Beaverton adopted one of the programs under the statute ORS 307.540-548 in order to give qualified not-for-profit affordable housing providers a 100% property tax exemption on land on which they intend to develop affordable rental housing or are actively developing affordable rental housing or where they have already developed affordable rental housing. As Mr. Van Lanningham mentioned, this tax exemption statute is an opt-in program. No city is required to enact it. We passed our ordinance enthusiastically, but with a tight sunset because of the limitations in the existing statutes, which don't give us an important degree of security. HB 2130A amends the statute and the other program, ORS 307-515-523, in order to allow cities to add project criteria or programming provisions so long as they do not conflict with the state criteria that any project serve people at 60% of median family income and be developed, managed, or owned by not-for-profits. Additional criteria, as Mr. Van Lanningham indicated, could include ensuring that the housing is built in a reasonable time frame. For instance, the program that we signed up with has a provision that if a not-for-profit indicates that it has purchased land with the intent to provide affordable housing, there's nothing in the statute that says they must do so in the next century. We are concerned about the opportunity for, as Mr. Van Lanningham described it, and as I have in several occasions in the past, for bad actors to game the system by using that aspect of the existing statutes to avoid paying property tax on properties that they're holding for whatever purpose. Given the fact that we do not have currently the ability to pull the exemption under the existing criteria from somebody who has met all of those criteria, we are here in essence to ask for the ability to establish such criteria on a local level with the understanding that from city to city, exactly which criteria make the most sense are going to differ. In our case, what we did with the current statute is we set up the program. We have begun granting exceptions, but we set up a sunset, which is due to expire this calendar year. We are hoping that we'll get the support of the legislature to make these modifications so that we can strike the sunset and essentially reenact our ordinance with full implementation. Last year and this year, Beaverton approved property tax exemptions for three affordable housing developments or projects. Two of them had already been in existence. One of them is being constructed right now. We are hoping for a fourth to come very soon. We like our affordable housing partners and hope to continue to work with them and others to develop more in the city of Beaverton. We are fully committed to constructing large volumes of affordable housing in Beaverton. We would like to continue to grant these property tax exemptions as they help us to help our lower income residents. We would like to remove that sunset. And with the passage of this bill, we believe we will be able to do so with security. In addition, as Mr. Van Lanningham indicated, allowing local communities to establish appropriate additional criteria that meet state requirements, we think will encourage other communities to enact this particular provision, which can offer some very interesting benefits to the developers of affordable housing. And with that, at the right time, I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Hello, Chair Bernhardt and the rest of the committee. Nice to meet you all. Thank you for this opportunity today. My name is Dorenda Schubert, and I have the honor of serving as the Executive Director of Bridge Meadows, which is an intentional intergenerational community devoted to helping families adopt children from the foster care system, support them in their endeavor, and then to support seniors who are struggling with their limited incomes. This affordable housing community creates a sense of belonging and has had significant impact on the health and well-being of the children and the families and the elders who have lived there. In our short time, we've also received some national attention that we brought to the state of Oregon through the PBS NewsHour, Newsweek, Forbes Magazine, and Eisner Prize for Intergenerational Excellence. It's been acknowledged for its innovation and the positive health and well-being outcomes. Today, though, I encourage your careful review and support of House Bill 2130, which would allow local jurisdictions to add criteria or program elements that are consistent with the state statute allowing property tax exemptions where the local jurisdictions allow it.
Move the microphone just a little further away from yourself.
I apologize.
It will distort less. Thank you.
By giving municipalities this ability, more localities will be willing to participate in the program, as Councillor Sanssouci has suggested. It also allows us to provide much more affordable housing in the state of Oregon. House Bill 2130 creates healthier guidelines for affordable housing projects based on the different needs of each of the municipalities. It can be too much of a risk for cities to participate in affordable housing, and this bill helps more cities participate, giving organizations like ours more opportunities to help our citizens and create more affordable housing in Oregon. Without these changes, the only avenues available to cities in managing their tax exemption programs is to either sunset, as Beaverton is experiencing, or to repeal the program. Thus, future programs may not be viable. The tax exemption is a critical tool for us affordable housing providers for assisting with the financing of our projects. The tax exemption is supportive to the operating pro formas, allowing more funding to go directly to the services of the residents. Furthermore, when municipalities provide such a tax exemption, it gives us the indication that there exists local support, and we can utilize that to leverage other financial support. Our board of directors and leadership recognize how a community such as Bridge Meadows meets the city of Beaverton's community vision to bring together the generations and create more affordable housing for our vulnerable seniors. And we also recognize that cities should be able to have reasonable expectations of its partners. So please support the proposed legislation in House Bill 2130. This will provide an opportunity for Oregon seniors and families and children to have access to safe, high-quality, affordable housing. Thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Boy, you guys were thorough. Thank you very much. We have one more witness to be heard from, Eric Kankler. Could be. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 2130? Please, go ahead.
For the record, Eric Kanzler representing the City of Bend, and with such a thorough presentation preceding me, I really don't need to go into much detail at all. The City of Bend supports Senate Bill 2130 and allowing for the customization of the local tax exemptions. In the conversations that I've had with our affordable housing manager and planning staff, the addition of the local opportunity to customize and craft policy to suit the local needs, deter bad actors, and so forth, that will put this on the table for serious consideration, which I don't think was the case previously. So we're very supportive of those local options to do that. And with a rental vacancy rate that's shy of 0.5% we're supportive of. Anything that you can do, especially allowing additional local options to occur by making changes at the state level. So unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you. Representative Benz, please.
The reason I didn't bother the previous panel is because I'm afraid these questions are really directed at the existence of the program in its entirety as opposed to the refinement that's proposed by the bill. But Ben's a kind of a growing place again, at least it appears to be. Mm-hmm. And so the issue is the real need for the program. So maybe you can share with us why there isn't a whole bunch of housing being built in Bend right now, or maybe I'm wrong, and maybe there is. I just drove through the other day, and it appears to me there's a lot of construction going on. Tell me how much low-income housing is currently being built in Bend.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, that's a very good question. And I don't know that there's an overly simplistic answer, but I would say that, you know, one of the things that we're working very hard on is an expansion of our urban growth boundary. We do have a pretty severe limitation on our land supply, which I don't think the UGB has expanded since 1980, and we've been over 10 years in that process. One of the things that will do is allow us not only a greater land supply, but an opportunity to rezone. Most of what we've seen develop previously has been single-family detached homes. A lot of what we'll see in the future will be that as well. But we do have a very dire need for a greater diversity of housing stocks and a need within the growth boundary to have a variety of tools and mechanisms to make sure that projects of different types pencil. So I think when we look at this, you know, we're looking at a lot of different things. And I don't think we can look to one particular tool as being the answer. So this is just, you know, putting this on the table for consideration could yield some benefit. More specifically than that, I can't say.
Yes, please.
So it appears to me from my observations of that area is that the low-income housing appears to migrate towards certainly not Sisters, but how about Redmond or Madras even, and then people commute back into Bend because there is low-income housing out in that direction. It's hard not to make meaningless and non-productive remarks about all that space that exists to the east of Bend, but I'll just move on past that and suggest that
we've heard it before.
Yes, you know,
yes.
Yes, earlier today.
Yes.
The question is, how can you show us that the device, that if it becomes more refined, it actually begins to work better, is not what we would call a free ride device? We really need to understand that better, because I don't know why it would help you sharpen a tool that's only going to make it easier for people to use something that's not really needed.
That's Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, that's an excellent question. And I think in order to demonstrate anything concretely one way or the other, we would need to go through that exercise. I would defer to those cities that have implemented the tool and those that have spoken before me in more detail about what's occurred thus far. Our primary interest at this point is in feeling that the opportunity is there in the first place. We do have a lot of nonprofits that, you know, their work is on the margins for the most part in terms of whether something pencils. And our question is what we can do about that. Increasing land supply drives costs down. That could be one component. This could be another component. So there is no hard answer given the fact that we don't have direct experience with this policy to this point.
And follow up, Mr.
Pace.
Right, and we're getting to the point that is of greatest interest to me, and that is whether or not this device and many others are designed to offset the cost of a mismanaged land use program. And so when you give us the detailed report that will answer all my questions, would you ask, you know, address that part also? And I'm not so much joking as it may sound. We really do need to know if you happen to see this nexus between self-imposed lack of land when there's gazillions of acres and the cost and who's sharing it, like our schools, because I think that's what's really happening here. And I'd love to have you take a shot at that in whatever report we might get back. And I'm totally serious. So just even if it's just something you blurt out in your report so people don't forget that I raised the issue, that would be helpful.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, report being what happens with our urban growth boundary expansion, what happens with the implementation or the discussions around this policy?
Yes, how about, excuse me, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please, yeah.
A follow-up letter to this committee to be included in the record saying, here's why we think this 20-year program, which gives us 20 years of tax abatement refined with this new tool that we want in this thing, and the reason we need this is because we don't have enough land to build low-income housing on, so we need this additional break so that we can afford it within the constrained areas we've got because the land prices are higher. That's what I want to see in the letter. Any way you want to put it, but it'd be nice if it kind of repeated what I just said. That'd be great.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, assuming that there is a local discussion that has some detail, that I would be very happy to report back to you directly and to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we deal with very complex areas, and Representative Bentz raised a couple of really important ones. I'm aware, sort of as an outsider driving through, that Bend is becoming prosperous yet again, at least in terms of land values, housing prices, and that kind of thing, traffic, et cetera. And that does have the effect, doesn't it, right now, of driving lower-income families to the periphery, to towns that are several miles away, mm-hmm. With giving them long commutes to get into Bend to work where their jobs are, those kind of things, and that if I understand it, this is one of a number of tools the city might use to try to ameliorate that set of problems.
Chair Barnhart, there's a and members of the committee. Again, yes, it's a tool. I would say that the prosperity for us has been ephemeral in the past. We certainly have boom and bust periods right now. The economy is quite strong, largely related to tourism. And one of the negative sides of that is the emergence of, B&B or VRBO rentals, short-term rentals. So I think I misspoke with one of those acronyms. But that's a specific dynamic of that's particular to the city of Bend that has caused a lot of displacement. So, land supply, the crunch for affordable housing, it's really a result of a variety of different things. It has had the effect of sending people out to neighboring towns. And, of course, as a city government, we aspire to plan for a complete community to whatever, the greatest degree possible. So we certainly encourage your consideration of this and other tools with that in mind.
So if you're going to service the other industries in Bend, and if you're even going to be able to service the tourist industry, you need workers who live nearby, who are willing to come to work, even though most of the houses much of the year are empty because they're rentals that don't happen to have anybody in them that week. Is that a fair summary of what you're describing?
Chair Barnhart, it is. We would much prefer every element of our workforce have a fair opportunity to live within the city.
Thank you. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find this discussion about UGBs fascinating. In my district, specifically in Hood River County, our two incorporated cities both lie squarely within the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Area, which since that legislation was passed in 1986, there has been no expansion of the UGBs, and there are no discussions on the horizon indicating anything like that will happen anytime soon. So obviously, as we're not unlike Bend in terms of an area that's desirable and lots of tourism and stuff, second homes, but all that serves to do, supply and demand kicks in, obviously, and we're not creating any more dirt. So the cost and the price of what we have becomes exorbitant, which drives out those folks who can't afford to live there. So attainable housing is what the discussion is in Hood River County right now. It's a very real concern. So local entities, governments, are looking for flexibility in how we can best utilize our existing land base in a way that can hopefully create some of those situations where we can make some of these situations affordable and pencil for those organizations that are willing to do that. So I totally understand what Ben's dealing with and going through, and I think it could, obviously, other communities, I think, up and down the Willamette Valley may have similar issues as well, but I appreciate what you guys are going through. I can empathize with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony and that of the others we've heard from today. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2130. And colleagues, we've completed our business. See you all tomorrow. Is that Paul? Yes. Before we go, remember that our first duty will be to arrive at the Joint Tax Credit Committee at 8:30 tomorrow morning in this room. Senator Hess will be chairing the meeting, and he's not nearly as forgiving as I am about the time of the beginning of the meeting. Senators are here on time, and so we must be as well. Thank you very much. See you then, and also at 1. And that we're adjourned.